Welcome to the Revenue Lounge, a podcast for revenue operations professionals who want to understand the various facets of this important go-to-market function. In each episode, the team at Nectar interviews revenue warriors on how they are reimagining revenue operations in creative and disruptive ways, and what are their secrets to building a scalable and predictable revenue engine. Let's get started.
Data is everywhere, but the challenge lies in turning that data into actionable insights. For revenue operations teams, reporting isn't just about tracking what's already happened. It's about using the data to drive strategic decisions, enhance performance, and fuel future growth. But how do you make the leap from simple data collection to meaningful forward-looking insights that align with broader business goals? And how can RevOps reporting evolve to not only reflect past performance, but also provide a clear roadmap for the future? Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Revenue Lounge podcast. I am your host, Randy Likas, and in today's episode, we will explore the journey from strategic planning to the execution of RevOps reporting. We'll dive into the common challenges teams face, the key steps to turning data into action, and the different phases of maturity in RevOps reporting. Joining me today is Tyler Will. Tyler is the Vice President of Revenue Operations at Intercom. Prior to Intercom, Tyler led the global SMB sales strategy and operations team for LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Tyler, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Randy. Good to be here.
Great. Tyler, I'd like to start and learn a little about you. So maybe you can talk a little bit about your background and your current role at Intercom today.
Yeah, absolutely. So my Intercom role is about a year and a half in now. Started out leading the sales operations team and now revenue ops when we brought the marketing ops team in about 9 months ago. And I lead about 30 people across a range of functional areas. So we've got a core ops team that's deal desk and then the day-to-day kind of sales-facing folks doing forecasting and book carving and all those kind of activities. We have a planning and comp team that's doing incentive design, setting targets every quarter, and working really close with our finance crew. We have a go-to-market analytics team that does everything from top of funnel all the way through to renewal reporting and analysis, which is big focus for us today, so that's exciting. We've got a strategy team that kind of does big company initiatives, and then a systems team that works on our tech stack. Okay.
I agree. So Tyler, you know, I do a lot of these conversations and I talk with a lot of RevOps leaders like yourself. And I think the challenge that many have is RevOps leaders want to have a seat at the strategic table, but you're also on the hook for delivering the insights back to the business, right? And I think it goes beyond reporting. It would also be about just delivering that key value. What's your perspective and what are the key steps involved that you do to stay strategic with your cross-functional teams?
Yeah, I think there are a few different things we do. And one of the keys is demanding that seat at the table and having, you know, the right confidence to just say you deserve to be there. But I think one thing we found to be really helpful as we think about tying this into the reporting piece is that any strategic planning needs from the beginning include that idea of reporting and execution monitoring and all of that. And I think where I've seen projects get in trouble is they assume we're going to do all this work and we're going to flip some switch on whatever day 100, and then we'll see what happens after that. And that's when you get into the questions of, was this investment worthwhile? Was it successful? Did anything work? Oh, things went wrong. Like, why didn't we find out for a while? And so we've, I think, done a pretty good job recently at Intercom in planning for all the way to D-Day and then 30 days or a quarter beyond that to try to bring that in. And that lets us in RevOps and the reporting function within RevOps be part of that conversation, because everybody recognizes the only way you're going to get all the way through that is having them understand what the business need is, what the problem you're trying to solve is. So we're really lucky in that we have a great project management team or program management team that helps us think through this, keep us organized and do that. And so one step I'd suggest for people, if you don't have a formal function, is designating somebody on one of these bigger projects. It's like, you're gonna kind of program manage. Oh, sorry, the cat decided to join us. Really unhelpful timing. I don't know if you edit that out or not. Yeah, so we have a program management function. Keep that, it makes me a human, right? Yeah, so we bring this program management team in and they keep us organized. What are the best practices? How do we keep all the cross-functional parties deeply involved and deeply aligned? But even if you don't have that, you can really bring somebody in and just say, hey, 5% of your job is going to keep us on track, is keeping us on track, keeping everybody coordinated, setting these milestones. And so that's helped us, I think, even on smaller things, just stay focused on the strategy all the way to the execution and the management. So that's one tip I found to be quite useful.
And oftentimes, I think you're building these dashboards, you're building these reports, and the data's there, right, for the leaders to take a look at. I've often heard, like, we build all these great things, but nobody looks at it, right? Yep. So then what happens is you get all these ad hoc requests and you're like, it's all there, right? There's two parts of the question. One is, do you often find that as well? And how do you manage to that?
Yeah. So easy question. Yes. I think every RevOps team out there has at some point built the requested dashboard as designed and then looks at the either the counter in Tableau of how many views it's gotten or just asks around. It's hugely disappointing for what we thought this was going to be. I think there are a few things that we can do. One, again, following up, there's one thing to launch the dashboard. It's another thing to then support the use and implementation of it. If you haven't actually enabled the sales leaders who may not be the most comfortable looking at data and coming up with their own hypothesis and doing their own work, what do you expect them to do? And I think that's a failing on our part to just say, not only here it is, but here's how you use it. Here's how you think about it. Here's some questions you might want to ask and try to answer. There's probably a cultural element as a sales leader. If you're sort of like, hey, sales team, what do we know? Sales manager, what do we know? Oh, we don't know anything. Well, I'll go talk to RevOps. If you can enforce some accountability there, that certainly helps quite a bit. And then you know, one of the other things I think we found, and I think it's a theme that we're going to talk about today, is taking that sort of the facts, the report, and turning that into actions and ultimately, or insights first and then ultimately some actions.
Yeah.
Is setting up the mechanisms, the forums where you're actually going to do that. Again, there's a little bit of, I think, wishful thinking. If you say, well, we provided you with all this data, why aren't you doing something with it? Now, if you say, hey, we provided you with a bunch of data, and the third Tuesday of every month, we sit down and have a conversation about pipeline, and you as a sales leader or me as a RevOps leader are going to ask you a bunch of questions, well, now there's pressure to understand it and dig in and use it in a constructive way. And I know what good it's going to look like at that moment and how it's going to be used and what I'm expected to know. Mm-hmm. Now there's a reinforcing mechanism for this thing as opposed to, here it is, aren't you happy? Why aren't you using it?
Yeah, so let's dig into that a little bit more. So I think what I'm hearing you say, and certainly I experience it myself, is there's no shortage of data, right? There's a ton of data out there. But what's actionable and how do we help the leaders understand, the cross-functional leaders understand how we translate that data into an insight? Right. And so curious just how you do that today. Like, is it others? Do you try to turn the data into narratives or stories that align to overall KPIs, or like what's that, what's that process look like and sort of that cadence look like?
Yeah, I think this is very hard. And this is hard even within RevOps, let alone asking other teams who aren't spending day in and day out working with data. And so I could maybe talk to it most from the RevOps side. But I think there are a couple ways to think about framing it. And that may help people just turn unstructured data a little bit into a narrative. One is a classic from my consulting days, a situation complication resolution, which basically says, hey, what's going on? Why is that interesting in some way? And what are we going to go do about it? A shorthand of this is so what and what now, which I think can be a little easy one to remember. Like, here are the facts. Here's why those facts are interesting. Here's what we do about it. This, again, is a place where I find I do somewhat of a poor job of this with my team of like, guys, you got to generate more insights. And then you walk away. And what you really need to do is actually sit and spend time with people and coach them and show them what good looked like. None of us showed up on our first day of work knowing what an insight was. And an insight is a little bit in the eye of the beholder. There's not a dictionary definition of like, once it does this, it's now an insight. And until that point, it's not. And so when we talk about that, sort of that framing a lot, like the so what, the what now, or the situation complication resolution. And I spent 90 minutes just last week, we do a pipeline report and we were trying to get this and get some traction within it. And it frankly just wasn't working. It was a lot of just data. And then we'd have a table and then underneath that table would be a bullet point version of that table. And just because you turned it into words doesn't it doesn't make it an insight. It's still just the data point from the table. And so we actually broke down. I had my go-to-market analytics leader was in the room with me, super sharp guy. And then we had the ICs actually who build this stuff. And we sat down and we're like, what is good going to look like? Let's rip this whole thing apart. Let's rebuild it from the ground up. Because I think that's the only fair way to hold somebody accountable for something being good is to actually show them what you want them to do. You do the same thing in sales. You wouldn't be like, go prospect. And then be like, you did a terrible job. You actually have to show them what that looks like. And I think too often, either we as RevOps leaders, we have this, I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it. Or sales leaders who we're giving this stuff to, marketing leaders who we're sending things to. We don't take the time to say, here's what I really need. Here's what I want this to be. Here's how you can make this thing interesting to me, make me want to engage with it, and set a really clear target. And that may feel like too micromanagey for some people. And I think that's why we tend not to do it. It's like, I don't want to micromanage the team. I don't want to tell them how to do their job. But if you've never given them a sense of what their job actually is, how are they supposed to do that and do that successfully? And so mm-hmm. it's something I personally am working on, my team is working on, is to get out of the vague order of go create insights and actions. Let's actually templatize this. What are we going to show? How are we going to talk about it? How are we going to feed qualitative input into that? And ultimately, how do we then be really clear at the end of like our three next steps are thing one, thing two, thing three, and here's who's going to go own them. Now, if I'm the IC doing that, you know, a couple years out of school, like it's not quite paint by number. I still have to think and do it and bring my technical skills to it, but it's a little bit more of a solvable problem. And I think historically, we as RevOps leaders and sales partners have done a bad job of doing anything other than demanding more insights and demanding more actions without actually helping the team figure out a way to do that.
And I imagine if you're going to try to deliver an insight, you got to really have an understanding of what's the problem, right? Like, what's the problem that we have so that That's we right. know what we're trying to derive this insight towards. And it's amazing, like as you talked, I was making some of the parallels in sales. Like so many times we'll talk to somebody and they'll tell us what a problem is and we'll say, well, can you help me understand what's that impacting? And they'll say, well, I don't really have good visibility in terms of what's going on. So what, right? And so if you don't have visibility, what's that preventing you from doing? And it's getting into that second or third degree need or problem, which is going to, I think, help you actually understand what you're trying to deliver.
Yeah. And I think one of the flip side a little bit to this, and at least in RevOps, is there's often one or two people doing this work. And what is asked of them is an enormously complex range of things, right? You got to be technical enough to pull data out of your data, like out of Snowflake or whatever. So you're writing SQL code, you're putting it into a Tableau dashboard. You're senior enough that you understand what a good deliverable looks like and how to communicate with executives. You're deep enough into the business so you can actually contextualize whatever it is you're doing. And then you're a really good communicator who can put this all together and send it out and have a discussion. Like, that's a big, broad workload. And yeah. So how do we make those things easier for people to be successful is, I think, really important.
You bring up an interesting point, which is, I think, the experience to be able to do that. And I think a lot of it has to do with business acumen, right? So yeah. Typically, like who on your team, like what level of person would be the person trying to thread together the data to come up with the insight? I'm sure you probably have maybe more junior people, the data analysts sort of running it, right? Who's responsible on the team for putting that together?
Yeah, so we have some data analysts, but they've actually done well and have been promoted up a little bit. So there's a little more expect out of them. We have a couple senior managers leading the analytics teams. And then it becomes me at the VP level or maybe some folks at the director level, depending on the audience who are doing that. But I think that's one of the big challenges. And again, maybe one of the mistakes we've made is treating analytics like an academic shop and treating the rest of the function like the actual business people. And so it's just really hard to answer questions thoughtfully if they're just being lobbed over a fence and you go off to your little ivory tower and conjure something up and then throw it back down and hope people use it in a useful way. And so it's a silo, on our team right now, and something we're really trying to break down thoughtfully so that the business folks, like that core ops team that's doing the forecasting and doing that day-to-day work, really sales facing, is connected enough to the analytics team and vice versa, so that information is flowing in a much better way. Like, we have a pulse on the business. We're not just sitting here with our noise canceling headphones on waiting for someone to ask me a question, then I do my data and then I send it back out, but to try to get some of that business acumen in. So we're experimenting with that a little bit. I think the profile of who you hire is really key. Like, I'm biased toward former consultants because I've spent 12 years of my life as a consultant. So I think we, you know, can do lots of really valuable things and bridge some of that. But it's a tough profile because you do have to be technical, willing to be heads down, thinking about some of that, just roll up your sleeves kind of work, and then be able to pull up and operate at an exec level when you're communicating. So it's not easy. It's a tough job.
And then do you have people aligned to particular functions? So you might have someone that's really focusing on the CS side, and you've got somebody who's focused on pipeline, and maybe you have somebody at top of funnel and medium bottom of the funnel, and then you have like a marketing ops. Do you find that it's best if we have specialization around the core competencies to do this work?
Yeah, we do have exactly what you said. We have a marketing person who will help with campaign analysis and visits and sort of top of the funnel, and we've split that work across our web team a little bit, but we've got that. Then we have a top of funnel down into the sales funnel. So deep understanding with one person there, then a new business kind of funnel expert, and then an existing business renewals person.
Yeah.
It works reasonably well in the sense that they each have different stakeholders. They're mapped nicely to one or two relationships rather than everybody's got four pretty shallow relationships. But you've created a different set of seams in the business, right? Where one person's sort of like, oh, it got to stage one, not my problem anymore. And then the next person tells their story and then it's like, oh, now it's up for renewal. Like, I don't know, not my problem. So finding that right matrixed organization and matrix set of responsibilities where people are at least conversant enough, familiar enough with things that you can talk and share expertise and share insights. And even just little things like, and this is so silly, but it comes from my kind of consulting days. Like, why do you spend so much time making the deck look really nice at the end? And part of that is it adds that level of professionalism, coherence, that just makes people like buy into it a little bit more. And so when you split things that way, you might get one set of dashboards that looks one way and another set that looks another way and another set that looks another way, and they build slides differently. And so it can create problems of people in the audience then feeling like, hey, am I getting a story that's actually tied together? Do I understand how each of these things work such that I, as a senior leader, our go-to-market president, can she go look at a series of dashboards and follow something through in a logical way? And so it's a lot of effort when you are divided the way we are to make sure those seams and those overlaps are not too big and stuff falls into the gaps.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you what constitutes a valuable insight, but I think you answered it when you said we have to understand what, the so what, and the what now. But I don't want to make assumptions. So is there anything beyond those things that constitutes that?
This, I sort of was joking. This is like the what is obscenity Supreme Court case. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. And there is absolutely an element of that. It is in the eye of the beholder a little bit. But since I knew this question was coming, I think an insight, like when does it tip over from a fact to an insight? And I think it becomes an insight when it's data or some feedback, you know, qualitative insights certainly are just as valuable, that's presented in a context or in a positioning that isn't the way we've necessarily considered it before. So mm-hmm. It's encouraging us to think about a problem that we didn't know existed or look at it from a new perspective. And it's like a really simple example of this is you come to your RevOps team and say, how much pipeline do we have for this quarter? How much open pipe do we have right now? There's a fact answer, which is, $20 million, right? That is factually true. Maybe that was the question you were answering, but that is not actually insightful, right? What starts to get insightful is, hey, Randy, you got 20 million open pipe right now. That's 10 million less than we had at this point last quarter and a year ago. And if that seems like a risk to me, what do I know about sales? But that seems like missing a third of the pipe is a problem. Hey, not only does that seem like a problem, the reason is, oh, we accidentally broke our lead form for a month and didn't notice, like, so we didn't get any leads, or that campaign didn't work, or whatever it is. Now this is interesting. Now you're in a position where you can talk about your business as, hey, there's a big risk, or maybe you've got 60 million of pipe and you've only ever had 30 before, and now it's like, do we need to hire people? I didn't think about it that way. Do we have enough AEs to go deal with this business? Do we have enough SDRs to process all the leads that for some reason are coming in? Is this sustainable? All of that comes from the same basic fact of, you have $20 million of open pipe. But it's only actually an interesting number when it's in the context of a trend over time, the implications for the business, a reason behind why it's up, down, you know, sideways. And ultimately, we want our teams working together, working with marketing, to be able to say, well, we got this $10 million hole. Hey, we could quickly spin up some SEM, some paid campaigns. We've got an outbound program that we used to use. We haven't been using because we've been pretty busy with inbound. Like, why don't we go rekindle that quickly and see if we can at least get something going? And worst case scenario, at least we know we got to go tell the CFO, this one's going to be a little ugly. Like, sit tight, but we're on it. And we're telling you now, not telling you after it happened when somebody goes, hey, why did we miss our new business number by, you know, 30% or whatever it is?
Yeah.
And so that tipping point to me is now we're having a conversation. Now there's something interesting, not just it was a number that I guess answered the question I asked.
And so for that example, you would give it about like, you know, we have $20 million worth of pipe, but we've, you know, lost 30 million. When does that conversation start, right? When do you start working on the articulation of this?
Yeah, I think, again, coming from a consulting background, we always tried to have this notion of being hypothesis driven, right? You don't just go in and like, let's stare at the data and see if anything bubbles up, and you spend a lot of time just poking around. But this notion of, hey, we have a hypothesis. And so this might be coming from a conversation, say a forecast call where our pacing is shallowing out, right? Normally we got to go up at this rate, and right now we're coming in lower. And if we project that, we're gonna have a miss. Hey, what's our hypothesis behind that? Now I can start like, well, why would we miss? Our win rates are down, our ACVs are down, our number of opportunities are down. Oh, cool. It's actually our number of opportunities are down. We're not closing enough logos. Why is that? Oh, it turns out we don't have enough in the pipeline to possibly, you know, the deal size is the same, but the volume is off, or vice versa, or whatever it is. That lets you, I think, cut much faster into trying to get to an insight rather than let's go see if anything interesting is happening in our pipeline, or let's go, well, why do we have a churn problem? Is really trying to start from that point. So that's one is, and I think that works well for more ad hoc kind of, ooh, something went wrong, or we heard something, or there's the scuttlebutt at the water cooler, to the extent anyone goes in the office and says any of those words ever since 1955 or whatever. But you can end up in that place. I think the other one that we've tried to build is a really clear reporting cadence about the things we think are most important. And so one of those is new business pipeline. Another one is existing business health, retention, churn, contraction. And by setting up a good cadence around those, we're trying to put ourselves in a position to anticipate some of this. So 3 weeks before the start of the quarter, we want to run a deep dive on our pipeline into the next quarter and have a sense of what's it going to look like? How do we get ahead of it? How do we maybe give ourselves enough time to react? 3 weeks into the quarter, we're running a process that is a narrative about how that quarter is shaping up and a refinement of that prior one. And we'll do something mid-quarter that's like, here's where we are, and we're starting to look ahead a little bit and get into the next quarter. And yep. So I think by being really clear in your plan and your cadence of like, at this point in the period, we're going to do this thing and look at it this way, it just sets you up to know we're going to look at specific things. We're obviously always open to some crazy thing that's going to happen, but hey, 3 weeks before the start of the quarter, we know we're looking at next quarter and we're going to look at it in a certain way. We can just tell that story because we're set up to tell that story. And then mid-quarter, here's how we're doing. Here's how we're pacing. Here's how the rest of the quarter looks. Too late to do a lot about it. We got 7 weeks to go, but at least we're like checking in on that. We know that's going to be our narrative then, and we start to get a sense of the next quarter. So maybe I'm too much of a, for the Myers-Briggs fans out there, too much of a J. I like everything nice and scheduled. But my wife would certainly say I'm too much of a J. So there's at least one vote in that camp. But we're able, I think, to manage just, as you said at the beginning, there's just data everywhere. There are so many infinite numbers of things you could look at and stories you could attempt to tell that might or might not be interesting. And we can contain it a little bit by at least setting up this structure. And then hopefully, with that being present, influence the marketing teams, influencing the sales teams, influencing the success teams on, here's what's going on, here are the risks we see ahead or that we're right in the middle of, and let them take a corrective action.
Yeah. So data is everywhere. There's a lot of it. But we also find that data is very fragmented, right? We all want it to live in Salesforce as our source of truth, but we all know that's not the case, right? And so curious, what do you do in the absence of data, or the data exists, you can't get to it? Any advice or practices in terms of how you make decisions around siloed data?
Yeah, so I think there are two versions of that. One of which is like the data is really hard to get to, but exists somewhere. And I think at Intercomp, we're really lucky. We have a wonderful team called RAD, which somehow got consolidated from research and data science. They dropped the S. Sounds cooler. So the RAD team will do a lot of that work, helping us really dig deep into the product data or financial data or whatever it is that we need. We've got data engineering teams. And so we're lucky that we're really well-resourced in this area to be able to try to pull things out. Really hard to do if you've got a 24-hour turnaround and then you're going to take your best stab at what you've got. Maybe that's a bunch of lagging indicator. I don't know the exact answer to this question, but I can surround it with a few pieces of data that you call the circumstantial evidence that suggests something is or isn't true. And so that's when you have some data, but not quite exactly what you want. The other sort of trick that I've used and have some examples of this being really successful is a little bit of, it's a totally theoretical exercise or largely theoretical exercise of what you'd have to believe and then a sensitivity test. And so imagine you're trying to decide if you want to pursue some opportunity to invest in customer success managers, right? And I've yet to see anybody really be able to like, hey, for every 10 fewer accounts a CSM is mapped to, you get like X percent increase in churn and contraction, right? No, I've never seen that kind of a correlation analysis done anywhere. Someone's probably tried. I'd love to hear about it if they were able to pull it off, but it's always a bit of a soft investment case. And so you can start to do a thing like, well, the four people we want to hire are going to cost us whatever, $800,000 a year. And we think they can improve churn and contraction by 5%. And then you can be like, well, if 5% is worth, I don't know, $10 million a year, that's a great ROI, right? You're getting a 10x ROI on that kind of a number. But what if they only improved at 4%? What if they only improved at 3%? What if we're only 2%? And you get yourself this break-even point or some sense of like, hey, if we can get this much improvement and that much improvement, it pays off. But anything less than that, And this is where executives are really valuable, because you can sit down and go, hey, anywhere in your life, in your 30-year career, have you ever seen worse than a 2% improvement or more than a 10% improvement? And they'll be able to tell you, there's no way that's going to happen. Or absolutely, I am 100% willing to sign up for a 2% improvement to get this and have the economics of this make sense. And so that kind of, what do you have to believe or sensitivity analysis is, I think, a really powerful way of quantifying something when you don't actually, you haven't run an A-B test or you can't run an A-B test. But it'll give you some confidence in, wow, for this to make sense, we need to, you know, close 65% more logos next year. Like, not going to sign up for that. Oh, 5% more? Absolutely, we'll sign up for that. And that can be a good way of putting some structure in sort of made up data, but quantifying something that otherwise you're going to have no ability to quantify.
Yeah. And what I like about that is also, again, I'm just thinking from a sales side of things, like when you start getting them to participate in that, right, you're getting more buy-in, right? And it's almost as if you're risk adjusting the insight, where it's like, this is what we think. Well, now we're not going to do that. And they're giving you feedback. So it's almost as if you're making it, you're getting buy-in up front on it and not necessarily like in the ivory tower saying, this is what we're going to deliver. Because a lot of times if they don't believe it, they're not going to execute on it or try to make it successful. It's what you had talked about is leaning on them from their experience, and it's creating buy-in, right? And it's, so it's not just you from this, your team from this ivory tower saying that this is the way that it's done. You're actually sort of risk adjusting it a little bit, right? Which I think actually can help make it more actionable or implementable, right?
Yeah. And it's a co-created business case at the end of the day for something like that versus aren't we smart and shouldn't you do this thing kind of an outcome, which is great.
Yeah. So let's turn the conversation a little bit towards, and I think we started to get into this a little bit, in terms of measuring the effectiveness of the insights that are generated. So what metrics or indicators should teams focus on to gauge whether or not the success of their reporting and their insights are making on the business?
Yeah, I think this is one of the hardest questions in RevOps to answer. And again, I don't have a perfect answer. It's funny, right? You're in RevOps, you're surrounded by marketing and sales, probably the two most quantifiable organizations in any business. Did you hit your quota? Did you drive enough leads? And we're sitting here like, I think it feels like we did a good job this time. I don't really know. So I've not found a great metric that's like, reporting is really working. But a couple things that I think matter a lot and are good indicators. One is, when you're producing this stuff, are people engaging with it? We talked at the very beginning, are you building dashboards and nobody's looking at them? Are you building dashboards and everybody's looking at them? And a good way to find out people are looking at it is when they start asking for more stuff on it. Hey, this would be even better if it had this, this, or this. We built a dashboard and you don't hear anything about it. It's usually a bad sign that no one is spending any time thinking about it. So how do we get engaged, which I feel like feels like a web 1.0, like eyeballs kind of metric, as our entire business model is engagement with our content. But I think it does really show you, like, are people, hey, we've got a meeting about pipeline or churn and contraction. Do people come? Do people engage? Are they finding it useful? And nobody needs another meeting right now. So if they're coming to yours, it's probably a good indication that it's working in some way. So that's maybe the best, like, early indicator. I think the second is just start to see, like, it's a little binary, but hey, we made a bunch of recommendations based on this work. Did people go do that? We said, prospect more outbound. There's some ways to do that. Do we see an increase in outbound activity? Did we see an increase in attempts running QBRs or whatever the thing is?
Yeah.
If you don't see that, you got a question. You at least have to go question, hey, was that not an effective report? Now, maybe the report was effective and nobody knew how to do the thing we asked them to do. And then it becomes a partnership with the enablement team or sales management or whatever it is. But at least you can start to go down that road of, like, are people taking action? And so I think that's really helpful. And last, and the hardest one, is the lagging indicators. We recommended a bunch of things. We pointed out an opportunity. We think people took action on it. And do we start to see that show up in the metrics? Do we see, did our hypothetical example case pipeline get back up to $30 million the next quarter? All right, we feel pretty good. That was impactful reporting and a useful insight. QBR numbers doubled or whatever it is. So those kind of things where they start to show up in the metrics and you get improvements in churn and contraction, I think are all really, really valuable ways. But it just takes a while to do that. Often these insights are not things that show up in the next week's data. It takes, you know, months, quarters even to really see a difference. By which point, everyone will forget that RevOps recommended it and take it themselves, but that's fine.
That's the life of RevOps, right?
That's the life of RevOps, that's right. unless it goes badly, in which case it was your fault.
So you had shared a couple of examples earlier, but I'm wondering if maybe it could be the recent past, it could be just throughout your career, or maybe a transformative example, right? Where you've had this problem and you've developed these actual insights. If you think of maybe the highlight reel, right? Anything come to mind as far as the one that has drove the most impact?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the one that drove the most impact, but I think it's a useful example that brings a few of these things together. So this is back from my time at LinkedIn. We were working on the learning business. So e-learning business, this is before the pandemic when everybody suddenly went crazy buying e-learning products. But we had a group of customers. We had one kind of account management function, and we had some customers within that that were everybody in the company had a seat. There wasn't a lot of growth opportunity, and it was really like a renewal management, a success operation. And then the same rep would own the other 2/3 of their book would be these kind of big growth expansion opportunities. Like it had been landed, but it hadn't been expanded. And what we were finding is some reps really liked working with the sort of all-in customers and making them successful as they could be and guaranteeing a renewal and doing that, but didn't really enjoy, let me go out and hunt and try to get, drive growth and that kind of thing. And so we ended up proposing that we had this hypothesis that we could actually create two roles out of what was one role. And that would make these all-in customers happier and make everybody else grow faster and make the reps happier because they were doing the kind of job that they liked. And so we had this hypothesis. We did all the segmentation work, figured out what resourcing we need, and then ended up in a place where we didn't have any data. Exactly the thing we were talking about before. Like we had no data. We had to hypothesize, can we increase expansion by 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5% on all the accounts that are left in the growth book? Can we reduce churn and contraction by 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5% on all the accounts in the other book? Does that improvement seem to pass the smell test? And then would that pay for the extra headcount we needed to run this role? And we sat around and had exactly the conversation you and I were talking about in theory of, gosh, am I willing to sign up for 3% here and 2% here? Because if so, this is a great investment. I think we'll do better than 1% and 1% where it's not a good investment. But hey, do we do this? And so we went through that exercise of debating it and deciding whether or not to do it. And some bigger strategy questions were then brought to the fore that we were able to talk about. And ultimately, we decided to launch the program and run it and carve out the books and reassign reps to these new roles and hire a couple new people. And then we saw it in the actual metrics of what happened. It was a really fun experience of one, watching the growth kind of increase on the growth book and then the churn and contraction improve on the other book. But the amazing thing was once those deep relationships with the supposedly already all-in customers were the focus of those people, suddenly they started uncovering other areas for growth. It was, hey, we've got it. Actually, you only sold us the US division. Let me introduce you to my friends in UK or Germany or Australia or wherever. And that team ended up expanding that allegedly unexpandable book anymore just because their mindset was different in the way they approached it. And it uncovered these opportunities that probably wouldn't have been uncovered otherwise. And so it was a really fun project because we got to go through this sort of whole exercise. Like we have this a little bit ill-defined hypothesis to all the analytics we could do to this very hypothetical, are we willing to sign up for this, to doing it and seeing it play out? And it ended up being, I think everybody would say it was a big success as we run that part of the business.
Yeah, no, that's a great example. Thanks for sharing that. That's really insightful. So let's talk about how I frame the question. So there's reactionary things that we're doing based on data that we have versus, and that might be, I'll use the analogy of rear view mirror, right? And then forward looking and the role that RevOps can play in some of the more proactive or forward-looking insights or ideas.
Yeah. And I think this comes back to the key of insights. Like there are insights about the past, right? There are lots of reasons to explore the past and learn things about it, but it's way more valuable to sit there 6 months ahead of a big churn and say, hey, this thing's at risk. Here's what we got to go do about it than it is to go, ah, that customer churned. I wonder what happened, and go back and dig in and understand all the problems they had with whatever the relationship, product, their own financial situation, whatever it is. So I think it's really incumbent upon the RevOps team to, and often these things come as like first diagnoses of things that went wrong, right? It's the like, we missed our number, we beat our number by 2x, like what, nobody hit their quota, whatever it is. It's your job first and foremost to diagnose that and understand what went right or wrong. We often spend time doing what went wrong and assuming the right part will just be repeated, but that's a little bit of a different question. I think the key and the missed opportunity is often to say, hey, now that we've gone back and looked at this thing, what do we wish we could turn in from that, like from that learning and that insight? could we turn into the forward-looking piece? Mm-hmm. So it becomes that, why did we miss? We didn't have enough pipeline. Oh, why didn't we have enough pipeline? We didn't run enough campaigns. Okay, now we ought to know. We got to run a certain level of campaigns to generate enough pipeline to be able to hit our number and continue to grow the business. But it is hard. There are so many retrospective questions that just pop up, as you said, in the business. And so I think one thing to do is to try to get that mindset ingrained in the team as much as you can. And then some of the things we talked about of, hey, build that forward-looking thing into some of your cadences, right? Forecasting is obviously an easy example of, forecasting is by definition forward-looking, but you know, spending time there, enhancing that with other, not just the reps and managers bottoms-up forecast, but what's the RevOps top-down view? Hang on, you're going to improve your GRR metric by 20 percentage points between now and the end of the quarter? Hang on, is that mathematically possible? Those kind of questions, I think, are useful. We can start being more forward-looking, doing it, like I said, doing it in some of the reporting. We're going to do 3-4 weeks before the quarter starts. We're going to look ahead to the next quarter and start to get on top of things. Hey, we're seeing churn and contraction for certain reasons as we do a diagnosis. What other accounts have those same reasons, those same events occurring today? How do we get ahead of that and how do we try to fix that, I think, is the key translation we need to make that makes RevOps go from being sort of a necessary fact finder to a really strategic partner to sales and marketing teams.
Yeah, I think there's one thing that's happening in the market right now, and this might not be the case at Intercomp, so if it's not, let me know. Yeah. But there's a lot of B2B SaaS companies who are really just struggling to generate pipeline. And because of the bastardization of the sales engagement platforms who have just been tons of volume, people are just becoming deaf. Even the good messages aren't making their way through because people just aren't doing it. And so what marketing is saying is the cost of developing an MQL is going up. The quality is going down. My conversions aren't happening, right? And I think the first reaction was, we got to double down, right? We got to do more. And certainly that's just not working. And where I've seen some conversations I've had is, maybe we need to think differently in terms of how we deploy our SDR resources, right? Maybe it's not about more emails and more calls. Maybe it's redeploying them in a more strategic way, doing account research, understanding business better. So I think that's one example of where we can start getting a little bit more forward looking. Curious though, does that example resonate with you, or is that not a problem at Intercomp?
Yeah, as you said, I think just about every SaaS company is like, more pipeline would be better right now. So definitely an Intercom hot topic of discussion. The reasons you're talking about are spot on. Like, I've only half jokingly said that in 2 years, BDRs are going to go door to door with a demo on their laptop, because the only way you get anybody's attention is to show up in person. So we're just going to go full cycle back to somebody driving around with samples in their truck. But yeah, it's absolutely the case where the market is just so saturated and everybody's solution is like more AI. And it's just like, I'm sure you get the same thing, like 20 emails a day and I just delete them. Even if it might be relevant to me, the pressure on my time and my willingness to sift through 20 of them to go, maybe I want to talk to two of these people by the end of the week. Nah. So the folks who I end up talking to are those who've done something more creative. It's an event. I participate in some of these roundtables where they just bring RevOps leaders together and going in, hey, this is sponsored by a SaaS company. At the end of the day, there's a commercial connection that's ultimately going to try to be made. But it's also a chance for me to talk to 7, 8, 9 other people dealing with the same problems I deal with. And I'm way more willing than when a BDR or somebody reaches out to me 2 weeks later to say, hey, I hope you enjoyed the roundtable. Here's a summary of it. Here's the contact information for everybody who's there. Also, if you're ever interested in a demo of our product, let me know. And I'm way more interested in engaging in that than I am in getting spammed. And so those kind of techniques, not quite door to door, but the in-person, make it interesting, make it relevant to me.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be amazed, right? Maybe you wouldn't be amazed. You probably see it all the time. Like, how many just badly written prospecting emails there are? You're like, there is no part of this makes me want to have a conversation with you.
Yeah.
And now there's 600 of those and it's just noise at this point.
Yeah. And it's only getting worse with AI. I think there's awesome opportunities, right, with AI, but writing more emails is not one of them, right? But on the AI topic and bringing it back to insights, what role do you see AI playing helping the data analysis piece to drive insights?
Yeah, and we're just starting to dip our toes into some of this internally, and there's security concerns and things like that that we're always working through. But my hope is that it sort of replaces the human in as much of this sort of first of the three steps we've talked about. Like, if you're a human and you're spending 80% of your time figuring out the what, like, things have just gone wrong. We need to get away from that. AI is such a powerful tool for, let me ask it a question and it will go crawl through all the data that it's linked to and come back and be like, here's your pipeline trend over time kind of stuff. Now I can sit there and say, like, why is that interesting? Why do I want to go spend some sales leaders or marketing leaders' time having a conversation about what this came back with? I do. Why is that? Because they can go do this about it. It can save so much of that just like heavy legwork and let people sit back and think and spend time figuring out why things are interesting. And then coming up with a creative, what do we do about it? Which is where I think humans are best, is that we're in a weird spot. We've never been in this spot before. I can pattern recognize this and I've got some interesting ideas. And now let's spend our time in a workshop thinking through how to do something about it, not the first 3 days of my week just hoping I can pull together a basic report.
Yeah.
So I think it will hugely change that aspect first. It will get better. It will keep getting better. We'll see how far up the chain it goes. But that's like on the horizon, if not already here, kind of opportunity for us.
Yeah, I agree completely. Last question, and then I want to transition into what we call our lightning round, which is just a little more on the personal side of things. So it's planning season right now, right? Everybody's heading into planning for 2025. And this is really related to data insights, but I'd just love to get your perspective. What's sort of top of mind right now for going into planning? It's efficiency, so resource utilization, is it pipeline? Would love to hear from your perspective how y'all are thinking about 2025 and some of the planning things you're doing.
Yeah, I think first and foremost, and again, a SaaS-wide trend is, it's harder and harder to find new customers, so we got to take better care and grow our existing customers more. And so at top of mind in our initiatives and our planning is, how do we understand that installed base of customers better, treat them better, find them the right products, advise them better, and really deepen those relationships. And so what resources do we need? How do we want to set quotas? Do we have the right incentives in place, our comp plans to make that happen and make that as easy as possible for people? Do we have the right policies and rules of engagement? All those things, is all that lined up to make that existing business as strong as we could possibly make it? So that's the, I don't want to call that BAU, but that's, I think, like a widely generalizable thing for folks. At Intercom, at least, we're all in on AI, particularly in the customer support space, which is our core product. And so there's a lot of effort as well figuring out, what does that look like? How do we monetize that? How do we want to incent reps to sell something that is much more of a consumption-based product? Mm-hmm. How do we start to make this evolution from almost what was almost entirely a seats-based world to one that is a mixture of seats and usage?
Yeah.
And overhauling, that's target setting, quota setting, comp plans, rep expectations, all these kind of things. And so we're spending quite a bit of time on the infrastructure to enable AI go-to-market. Mm-hmm. And so that's the other big one that's on our minds right now.
Yeah, you're the third person I've spoken to in about the past week and a half who mentioned we're going from a seat-based over to like a consumption-based. So I think that's a big trend we're going to start seeing a lot more of. And of course, there's all the fallout of that, which is, how do we design a comp plan that incents the rep to land the customer, but also gets the value over time. So great. Well, listen, I know we're running short on time, and so I want to transition over to the lightning round.
Yeah.
First question I have for you is, if you weren't in RevOps and you weren't in consulting and you had to pick a completely different career trajectory, what would that be?
I guess if I could wave a wand to do it, I would probably be, well, one of two. I'd either be a historian, because I love reading history and I always enjoyed that in school, and I think it'd be fun to just go research stuff and try to write a book. Skill-wise, I'd probably be better off being a lawyer, which is what my dad did, and I probably could have done as well, if not for the desire to not be like your father. So
yeah. Great. Okay, so you mentioned the magic wand. I'm going to pull a question out that I haven't asked in a while. So imagine you've got the magic wand. Time, resources, money are not an issue. What would you fix first?
I assume this is not like world hunger, but if I just confine it to my RevOps world, to that purview, which makes it a little easier, I think, I would get a lot of what we talked about right today. I would have to spend less time on just getting the reporting right and more on what it means and what we should do about it.
Yep.
If I could wave it for Intercom, as the consumer plus us, of getting the right understanding of AI and how it's going to work and the ROI and why it's valuable from both sides, I think that's the place that everybody's still stumbling through. I know I need it. I know I want it, but I don't quite get it and I don't quite trust it. And if we could get through that phase, I think the boom and growth for us would be huge.
Yeah. What's the favorite part of your job?
At the end of the day, it's solving these big, hairy strategic problems. I get to do that kind of day in and day out. I get to do it with really smart people who care a lot about the company, who care about each other. And there's just immense satisfaction. And we thought about it. We came up with an idea. We implemented that idea. And now we're seeing the results of it. It's just a ton of fun and gives me a ton of energy.
Yeah. I'm built cut from the same cloth as you. Okay. There's always a flip side to that question. which is your least favorite part? Yeah. Or ask it a different way, what's really hard about your job?
Yeah, I think the one word answer is meetings, which is probably everybody's least favorite part of their job, is just the volume of meetings. And being in RevOps, the remit is very broad. And so it's context switching constantly and finding the time and the mental energy to think deeply about these big problems that I find so exciting can be really hard to do. And so prioritizing and creating the space in your calendar to not wait till you do it at night when everybody else is asleep is a big challenge.
Yeah. So what's one piece of advice that maybe you got earlier in your career that like has stuck with you today that you're still applying and still thinking about?
Yeah, it's funny. I never actually had a conversation about it, but it always stuck with me. There was a sign on the wall in one of my managers when I was a consultant on the side of his office, and it said, play with a ton of confidence. And that always stuck with me, as I think one of the things that people, early in their career to the end, hold themselves back because they don't think what they have to say is interesting or valuable, or they won't question it or suggest an idea. And I always like reminding myself of that, play with a ton of confidence. Like, you were hired for a reason. You're here for a reason. You're invited to this meeting for a reason. Participate, share what you think, and to do that. And I think, especially for more junior people, I'll get on my soapbox for a minute here about this, but like, school trains you to get to the right answer, usually by yourself, right? Like, a math problem is either right or wrong. And you spent 13 years coming through college, like, either getting things right or wrong, usually by yourself. And then you get into the working world, and like, there aren't clean right or wrong answers. You can rarely do those things by yourself. And I think people early on in their career are often very reluctant to say, like, I have a half-baked idea. I've been thinking about this deeply, but I'm like part of the way there. I'm not sure. And my favorite conversations, my favorite opportunities to mentor people early in their career is when they've invested the time and the thought to try to get somewhere, but don't have all the context, don't have all the experience, but we can engage in a really constructive way. And so I really encourage more junior people to play with confidence. You're there. You've gotten to the point you've gotten to for a reason. And so believe in yourself and share what you're thinking, but also to know that part of sharing and part of doing this is not having all the answers. And the only way you're going to get them is by engaging with more senior people from different organizations or different parts of the organization. But you've got to have confidence to do that. And so I just encourage people to really embrace that mindset.
Yeah, I love that. Well, listen, Tyler, I have one last question for you, and it's not going to be a lightning round question, but it's one that I want to ask over the overall theme of the conversation. So what is the one question, if there is one, that I haven't asked you about how RevOps can help deliver more insightful, impactful insights that maybe I should have asked you?
Ooh, we covered a lot today. I think the one we touched on it, but it wasn't really a question, is what are the responsibilities of the audience to RevOps reporting in making it valuable? We talk about the feedback and the need to say, here's what it is. But at the end of the day, RevOps can't do the prospecting, can't have the QBR with the customer. And so this is a two-way street of, like, if we're going to put the effort into it, you've got to then take it and do something with it. And that can be iterative. You can keep asking for more, ask more questions, all great. But I think there's a, sometimes like it feels like it can feel, and I'm sure everybody in every corporation feels this way, but it can feel like a lot of the burden is put on the RevOps team without a like commensurate burden on the other side. Here's your commitment to us for having done this work to do something.
Yeah. Do you feel it's important to set that expectation up front? Like, look, we're going to do the work, right? But we need your commitment that you're going to do something with it.
That would be a good idea as we sit here and talk about it. I don't think I do it. And you don't want to walk around signing contracts about every, you ask me a question, well, I'll answer that, but only if you, boss, commit to do something. You're going to be the least favorite person in the office very quickly if you're that literal about it. But there is, I think, value, especially on bigger things, of saying, all right, this is going to be a big lift. I hope you understand this is going to be a big lift, which I think people often don't understand. It's just like, why isn't it just there? And so if we're going to do this, hey, let's make a commitment that you're going to learn how to use it. You're going to learn how to self-serve on it, whatever the kind of other side of that equation is. And I think everyone will be much happier ultimately if we can get to that place more often.
Yep. Well, listen, Tyler, I think this was an outstanding episode. Very insightful. Appreciate your insights and your candor. Great talking with you. And that's it for another episode of the Revenue Lounge. Goodbye, everyone.